From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. Let's open our week in review with a conversation about employee abuse. But it's more specific than that. One of the hours on Connections this week was inspired by actress Uma Thurman. She opened up to the New York Times about the abuses she has suffered on movie sets.
Now, Thurman says that director Quentin Tarantino spit in her face and choked her with a chain, inflicting emotional abuse instead of allowing Thurman to simply act out scenes in the movie Kill Bill. And it turns out there is an ugly tradition in Hollywood of directors calling for actual physical or psychological abuse of women. Director Bernardo Bertolucci infamously said that in 1972, while filming Last Tango in Paris, he allowed actor Maria Schneider to essentially be sexually assaulted. He didn't warn her that he had changed the script because he wanted her to be genuinely affected by an assault. She later said that she actually felt raped.
Our conversation included Gwen P. Scott, a local actor, and Tina Chapman DaCosta, who teaches directing the actor at RIT.
The whole history of acting and storytelling, I mean, if we look at what, you know, our early peoples wrote on the walls of caves, when we look at how tribes got together and displayed stories, you know, inside a fire circle, I mean, those things were done collectively and part of the group. I don't know how we got off the train coming to where we are now, where you have almost a tyrant type of behavior and everyone cows down and kind of just follows along. If you look at that article from Uma Thurman and the video that she finally got access to show one of these scenes where she's driving in a car. She's already said ahead of time, I don't feel comfortable in this unsafe car. It really wasn't steering very well. And she's told, it's going to be fine. Go ahead. It's a straight road. You'll be fine. It wasn't a straight road. It wasn't fine. She crashed into a tree. And then if you look at what happens next, no one immediately runs up to her. Maybe they're further away. So like that's understandable. But when they do, they don't really know what to do. I mean, when you watch the Super Bowl and someone gets a potential concussion, they have a whole process. They have a whole team that comes out and takes care of that player's needs. When you have an actress on set or an actor on set who has an accident, it's not always the case where someone knows what they're doing and they come out there and they help her. They had to carry her out of that vehicle. Tarantino was shown there rubbing her shoulder, I think maybe offered her some water or something like that, and find out later she has some, I think she said, permanent damage to her neck and to her knees. No profession is allowed to have that type of risk factor going on. We have family friends who are also wonderful actors, you know, in the industry, and there have been times when they've been on a set and not told that they have to do an underwater scene, and they were supposed to be given swim lessons and they weren't given those lessons, and all they can do now is go hide in their trailer and call their agent and say, hey, look, I didn't sign up for this. And eventually somehow somebody talks them into doing it, because time is money, the set is there, the crew is there, everyone is waiting. And unfortunately, the talent oftentimes is looked at as the lowest common denominator, you know, on the set. The crew always eats first, and we understand that because they have to get back on set and the talent eats last. But even the fact that you call them the talent versus a particular identifier, you know, for their role. And when you talk about the differences between men and women, unfortunately, it goes back to our history. And I'll say this. I talked to my mom this morning, who's almost 93. And when I told her I was coming on this show and I was thinking of other things to talk about, and she said to me, this is not new. It goes way back. Yes, way back to biblical times with David and Bathsheba, but goes even to slavery times, when you have a person who is a master of a plantation who can walk out and take any woman that he wants, and she can do nothing about it to speak up for herself or even her family to speak up for her. And for a person to be able to have that type of behavior and power is unnatural. And we are still living in the remnants of those types of relationships. Mm.
Gwen P. Scott is an actor. And, you know, if we talk about how to support actors, usually women who endure this kind of abuse, you've got Jessica Chastain. You have a number of other people speaking up now saying that this must change now. Are you seeing more standing up? And how do you view the importance of what we can do for one another in an industry like this?
It's one of the most important things that we have to pay attention to. I have seen more women taking notice of the different things that are going on and like being a bit more careful, but there definitely is not enough of, I guess, a connection between the people. People will look and they will see this situation that someone is in, and you can see on their face that they are physically uncomfortable about what's going on, but sometimes they feel as though they don't have the power to speak up, or they they just naturally think that if someone was uncomfortable, they would speak up for themselves, and they just kind of get scared, or they see they end up with the bystander effect. And it's something that everyone needs to sit down and think about and try to prevent, because we feel as though we should be protected. If we're putting ourselves out there, if we're getting deeper and deeper into the feelings and emotions of what we're trying to portray, in order to portray it correctly, we have to feel as though we are doing it correctly. Like, we can't say, I'm trying to portray being sad right now. We have to go into our feelings and our experiences and bring up the things that make us sad and make us feel it more. And that's how everyone will perceive it. And if we get cut deeper when we're already so exposed, it does permanent damage, and it's not something that's easy to recover from.
Next, a conversation with a man who spent part of the last year on the street, homeless, and part of the year staying in the Cadillac Hotel. The hotel is a historic Rochester downtown structure, but as beautiful as it is on the outside, it's infested with bugs and drugs on the inside.
Now, there are calls for the management of the hotel to get serious about improving conditions. We talked to Patrick Krebens, who spent 6 months there. He offered us a window into life for people who are homeless and desperate to find somewhere to go.
I had known about the Cadillac for years before moving in there. I had stayed there previously before moving in there last year. I was placed there through Trillium. Right around that time when DSS stopped sending people there. And that's really the only problem with a place like that not working outright is management. And unfortunately, it seems that that's where the property management has gone to it. They're taking any money that they could get and to keep it going the way it is, because, you know, the majority of the people that I see staying there aren't people from DSS. There are people that get a monthly check. You know, they get their SSI check or their SSD. And I don't want to say this come out the wrong way, but it's not money they worked for. So they don't really care spending the whole thing on it. Their money could be used to better their housing, let's just say, you know, to better their lifestyle, to better their life, you know, if they were to seek other housing. You know, like, I understand the follies. Like, I just spent an extra 4 months out on the street trying to find a place, you know what I mean, that would suit, you know, my personal needs. It's hard to find a place out there, you know, and, you know, I was lucky enough that there's the programs here in the city that, you know, that was to work with me and help me get a place, you know, because I spent 6 years, 7 years out on the street. Like, so this has been a huge transition, you know, and a lot of people that, like, when they finally get that option to, like, go into some place like the Cadillac, like, for me, I was so relieved to just be off the street and not in the elements that, like, everything else, all the other crap that was going on around me didn't even matter, didn't even bother me for the first couple months. But then it started, like, started creeping into my personal life, and it started affecting me, you know, and that's when the place really started. I started seeing the place for really what it had become, you know what I mean? And it was a headache, and it's a headache on the downtown area there.
Can you tell me a little bit more about that, the headache, the conditions?
A lot of coming and going of residents, you know what I mean? You know, if you don't have pride in where you're staying, then, you know, you're not going to care about it. No one's going to care about it. Yeah.
Did you have a single room yourself?
I was with a significant other.
Okay. And how were the conditions in your own space?
I was lucky enough I didn't have bed bugs in my room.
Were there a lot of bed bugs in the building?
Yeah, every floor I heard, you know. Okay. My mother-in-law stayed there at the time, too, and she was getting bit every night, you know. She, I think, changed rooms 3 or 4 different times. But yeah, that was, you know, they had the exterminators come in every other day, it seemed like.
Okay. You know. And for you then, did you see anything that was making anything better with management responding to any concerns? Did you have regular contact with management, or were they just not sort of a problem? They were.
Yeah, the exterminator guy, I wish I could remember his name, because he was really nice, you know, and he just seemed to be like, seemed to be too much for him, you know what I mean, to keep on top of, you know, cockroaches and stuff, and then dealing with the bed bugs, you know what I mean, and constantly people in and out. Mm-hmm. It's impossible to stay on top of it hotel setting, you know. In a clinical setting it'd be a lot easier, but it's you know, it's not that type of setting.
Did you feel safe there?
Yes, I did.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I did.
In general, do you think most people who stay there feel pretty safe there?
No, not at all.
Okay.
I do not.
Why is that?
Just a lot of the in and out, coming and going of the place, you know. I know drugs and prostitution have been, you know, huge in that area, you know, with that place. For the community not to look at that as an issue, you know, that's a big problem, you know what I mean? Because it continues to be a problem, and it's I don't think anybody who knows of the Cadillac knows of its problems, and to not talk about it, you know, is doing the place a disservice, doing the city a disservice.
We'll turn now to a concept known as the Magical Negro. It's an old idea made more popular in recent years by director Spike Lee. Here's the concept. A singular black person is called upon to save the day, either in a movie with an otherwise white cast or in politics, such as the recent calls for Oprah to run for president.
It's an idea that makes some people uncomfortable. An upcoming art series explores the issue, and we welcomed some of the artists behind it. First, you'll hear Rena Golden Collier, a spoken word artist. Then you'll hear Rachel DeGuzman, president of 21st Century Arts. And finally, you'll hear Nigel Gage Thorne, director of Future Point Dance.
I'm very clear about, you know, my position when I'm in those spaces and those conversations, that not only am I not there to make you feel comfortable with my struggle, it's in some ways counterproductive for me to do so. So I'm going to have to take a step back and let you sit with your fragility, you know, your discomfort, and still remind you that that's the reason for intersectionality as a concept, you know, and as a practice. Understanding and appreciating the intersectionality of all of our struggles is to say that, right, that's why, and right now this is why you feel uncomfortable, but I feel uncomfortable with your discomfort, because I'm simply stating that my struggle is different than your struggle right now. So we can't make it all the same thing.
That's the part that I think, and again, I got to be careful trying to overly generalize or sum up, but there were a number of white women who emailed me after the program and articulated some kind of a view that said, aren't we all on the same team? Don't we believe in these causes together? And if we are not united, we're going to get beat at the ballot box. We're not going to be able to move the country in the direction that we want, and that we may not all be in perfect lockstep, but isn't this essentially all the same team? What, generally speaking, Rena, do you agree with that or disagree?
I would say that we're only on the same team when you do make space for me to make a case for the places where we're not on the same team. So if we're saying that we have to somehow zoom out so far that we lose sight of our individual concerns, issues, problems, then we're not on the same team. If we can't bring that focus back to say, wow, this is something that is hurting or plaguing black women, and so therefore it's a women's issue. And so, you know what? Let's talk about that. Let's fight for that. Let's march for that.
And you had the issue with Lena Dunham, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where she actually was so outspoken about hashtag Me Too, sexual harassment, and how it's coming to the fore. But a biracial member of, or former member of staff, accused someone, a white male on her staff, of harassing her. And she said she believes them. So believe all.
She believes the man in that case.
She believed the man in that case. And I only mention that to say that that's what we experience all the time. And so you can't be on the same team if you don't recognize that, first of all, racism exists and it's impacting us in compounding the oppression that we experience. It's not in allegiance with the oppression that white women experience, even though I do agree they are oppressed because of misogyny.
Nigel, you want to weigh in on that, too?
Well, I just, something resonated with me, and it's about being uncomfortable. And I work with the body all the time, and it's my job to make you uncomfortable sometimes, because it's in a room, you know, especially if we're doing something like improvisation, because some people are very unsettled by not knowing, you know, everything that's going on, or knowing what's happening. And it's okay to be uncomfortable. And a lot of times it brings out, you learn so much from that moment that sometimes I think some people, yeah, you're uncomfortable. So just deal with that, own that, and see what you can learn from that situation. You know, uncomfortableness, is that a word, is so useful and so important, especially in this particular conversation, which is kind of what I'm going to bring with me to this installation, about how to resolve that and figure out what it's saying to you, rather than always trying to just get rid of it. It's like pain. It's like if you just take an aspirin sometimes, you painkiller, you never know what the problem underlying is. Like, you have to sit with that, recognize that that's what's going on, and that something is speaking through that.
Let's close the week with a conversation with rock and roll legend Eddie Money. The star is almost 70 years old, and he's written a musical about his life. That musical is called Two Tickets to Paradise, believe it or not, and it's making its world premiere in Rochester at the Kodak Center on Valentine's Day night.
The show is about Money's occasionally rocky childhood and relationship with his parents and his rise to stardom, and that includes a drug overdose that nearly killed him. I asked Money to describe the rock and roll scene from the 1970s and 80s when so many stars were falling into drugs.
When I was younger, I was smoking pot, you know, and back in the 80s, everybody started snorting cocaine, which was really, I did a lot of stupid things. And, you know, one stupid thing leads to another stupid thing. And this drug called fentanyl that actually Prince OD'd on, and now they found out that Tom Petty just died. It was a drug overdose. Very powerful drug. It's like synthetic heroin, and it's killing kids all over the country. It's a horrible drug. And, you know, actually, I did this drug, and I killed the sciatic nerve of my left leg, and I actually could not walk for 11 months.
When was this, by the way, 1980?
About 1981, 82, yeah.
I've read about the sciatic damage, but did you know at the time, is it like, was there an overdose and then you wake up and there's a part of you that's not working anymore?
Well, I'll tell you the truth. When I had the overdose, it was very strange because I remember I was in a semi-twilight state and I was on the operating table. They had to dialyze my kidneys and my leg, from laying on my leg wrong, it was so big they had to like cut it and it was really crazy. But I remember all the doctors working on me and Baby Hold On came on the radio.
Get out
and they're
of
going,
here.
God, this is Eddie Money on the table. And I'm going, wow. Is this a bad dream or what? But it was actually, there I am operating on me and Baby Hold On was on the radio. It was very crazy.
Wow. Did you see drugs just about everywhere? Was it backstage when you're doing
shows?
Well,
you know what? When I was doing drugs, I wasn't, you know, doing methadrine and smoking methadrine or shooting heroin or any of those stupid drugs like that. But it was doing drugs that was socially accepted. Like people with cocaine was socially accepted. I don't know why, but it was. And everybody was smoking pot. But that was years ago. I'm in a rigorous and honest program right
Absolutely.
Now. I'm very happy
with
my
life. But cocaine was more socially acceptable than other stuff then.
Well, cocaine was like, you know, if you had money, you had coke. It was like kind of like a status symbol, you know.
Did you feel out of no control is kind of on that theme, isn't it?
Yes. Well, they took me to the hospital. I wasn't going to go. My blood was running much too high. My heart was much too slow. The doctor had some questions, some things he had to know. My lady shook her head and said, the boy's got no control, because I had no control. You know.
Let's listen for a second. And this goes right back to those days, 82, I think.
Yes.
To the hospital, and I swore I wouldn't go. My blood was running much too high, my heart was much too slow. The doctor had some questions, some things he had to know. My lady shook her head and said, the boy's got no control.
And so it sounds like a fun song, but in this context, it sounds kind of rough, kind of tough.
It's dangerous. You know, you think about all these young kids, like 68,000 kids dying on opiates just on the East Coast. And you think about the parents of these kids, you know, going into their bedroom and the kid's not there anymore. It's like, you know, drugs are a tragic way to go. And now drugs are getting so heavy and so dangerous.
I mean, it could have been you. Did you think about that? You could have died there.
I could have died for sure. I only had a 40% chance of living, but I came through okay.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio. That's 89.5 FM.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app. Our thanks to everyone who called in or went online to pledge their support to WXXI this week. Thank you so much for helping us stay on the air. Have a great weekend, everybody. He's Evan. I'm Megan. We'll talk to you Monday.